Welcome all fiends and gumbo connoisseurs. Do not adjust your listening device. This is Nima Vidotti, Michael W. Dean's fellow fiend, checking in with my own interview for the Anarchy Gumbo. I'll be adding my own special blend of assorted herbs and spices to give the gumbo that heat you crave. Serving up fresh thoughts from special guests to help expand your anarchist palate. So open up your brain hole and get a taste of this. All right, this is Nima V of the Freedom Fiends. We're here on Anarchy Gumbo today, and I've got with me Will Coley. What's up, Will?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Let's go ahead and have you give the listeners a little bit of information about yourself. Sort of introduce yourself, if you would.
Well, my name is William Coley. I'm National Director for Muslims for Liberty. We're a group of Muslims and non-Muslims of a liberty-minded political philosophy, and we do educational seminars and write articles and such on concepts of libertarianism and anarchism as they're expressed in the Islamic legal tradition. I've done work with Tea Party groups for the last 3-4 years. I used to be a co-host on Tea Party Patriots Live on WORL 660 in Orlando. And, you know, I'm just a regular, everyday Tennessee redneck. Converted to Islam about 4 years ago. I've studied Islamic legal theory at a university in Qatar and comparative Western theology in Florida at Valencia College. I've lectured at universities across the country, and I'm glad to be your guest today.
Excellent. Well, that's some really interesting stuff. I appreciate a lot of the work you do, although I didn't know that you were – I guess that's sort of a recent convert, isn't it, 4 years? When I first – message with you on Facebook, I thought maybe you'd grew up to where, you know, one parent had some Arab or Islamic heritage in some way, and you sort of got into it that way. What made you get into Islam in the first place? I mean, that's might seem a little bit unusual to the average person.
Well, I've studied religion basically my whole life. I grew up in a Southern Baptist church until I was around 11 or 12. Then we became apostolic Pentecostal, so we went from a Trinitarian theology to what's known of as a oneness theology. And it was very fascinating to me how half my family said the other half of my family was going straight to hell, even though they read, even though they both read the same book, because of nuances and differences in each of their religious philosophies of morality and modesty and concepts of God. And because of that, it kind of set me on a mission throughout my life. I was that weird kid in the back of the classroom in eighth grade who was reading the Tao Te Ching and the Bhagavad Gita's. And just slowly over time, through being exposed to different works of religion, started studying Quran about eight years ago. And studied Islam for a few years, picked it up, put it down, just as kind of a part of my personal lifelong hobby of studying religion. And then some strange circumstances, it's kind of a long story to go into. I'd never actually met a Muslim or been, you know, I guess you could say proselytized to by a Muslim before the first day I walked into a mosque. And it basically made up my mind already at that point. Just through my own personal study and through my own exposure, you know, that I had exposed myself through my own volition, that I was a Muslim, though I didn't quite understand exactly what a Muslim was yet. But just based on what I understood of the religion, I felt that I was already, you know, 80% of the way there. I was asked to come to a new Muslim class, was given a fairly thick textbook by Yahya Imrich on Islam, read it from cover to cover in 4 days, went back the following Friday and took my Shahada. A week later, I was running the Feed the Homeless program at that local mosque. I happened to show up at the same time they were starting to start that. They were starting that program, and they needed a person with a food management safety license in the state of Florida to be able to get a health inspection to do so. And no one in the building except for me, who just happened to show up a week before they needed it, had that licensing. So it kind of seemed like divine decree from my own personal perspective that I just happened to walk into this mosque with the intention of becoming Muslim. A few weeks later, I was enrolled in an Islamic studies program at a university in Qatar through a WebCT program. A year later, I decided to focus my studies on Islamic jurisprudence, and it's, you know, been stuffing my head full of knowledge ever since then.
I can imagine. Well, how did your family and your community respond to you? Did you get any kind of weird looks, any kind of questioning, or was everybody cool with it?
Well,
it
depends on the family member, I guess you could say. I'm legally adopted, so I have a biological mother and I have legally adopted parents. My biological mother was like, "You're not doing coke and drinking a 12-pack of beer a day anymore and working in nightclubs and chasing wild women, so I'm happy." My dad was pretty much the same thing, though he didn't know the extent of my illegal extracurricular activities, I guess you could say. My adopted mother took a little longer to come around. Now she, as she puts it, likes my wife more than she likes me. my wife is a Kenyan immigrant. We met at the University of Central Florida. I was lecturing at the university, and we just kind of hit it off and got married a few years ago. About a year after I became Muslim, we met, and now we have two beautiful children, a one-year-old and two-year-old little boy. And you know, my uncles were very cool about everything. I lost the wife that I was with when I converted. She just wasn't ready to give up the lifestyle that we were living before I became Muslim, and decided that she preferred that faster life than the one that I had decided that I had chosen for myself. So, you know,
okay.
Well, always predict what will happen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You got to roll with the punches. I do wonder, though, where did liberty come into play as far as getting into the libertarian community? Was that after your conversion to Islam?
Yeah.
Okay. So you were like, "Hey, family, I'm Islamic. And not only that, but now I'm a libertarian, too."
I was pretty liberal, truth be told, before I became Muslim. And the more I studied the concepts of jurisprudence that I study the Maliki school specifically of Islamic jurisprudence, of the four main schools. I study the Maliki school of jurisprudence. And the more that I studied, the more libertarian, conservative my leanings became, being exposed to, you know, works by Ibn Tufayl and Shihab al-Din al-Qarafi and Al-Ghazali, who's actually Shafi'i, but he's still an amazing, brilliant writer and philosopher and scholar, in my opinion. And understanding the concepts of sound money, as they're expressed in the Islamic legal tradition, free and fair trade, as they're expressed in the Islamic legal tradition. And the more I learned, the more I saw mirroring concepts between our own constitutional legal system and the Islamic legal system, finding that a lot of times some of the basic precepts that we see as uniquely American or uniquely Western freedoms either exist or originated in Islamic law long before the Constitution or the common law existed.
Wow. Wow. Why don't you give us a little bit more detail about that, about the Islamic tradition of sound money and free trade? By free trade, I'm guessing you mean not having the state involved. Is that what you mean? And is that also what you mean with sound money, having a market currency?
Well, in Islam, a currency has to have an intrinsic value, not be worthless paper that's printed with a picture on it that the state or a bank tells you how much it's worth today and could change that worth to zero tomorrow if they so chose to do so. Most often it was gold or silver, but you also, in areas where gold or silver were not, there was not a lot of it in the supply, you have the ability to use other non-perishable goods such as dates or salt or barley as a currency. You could use these commodities as a form of currency to facilitate trade. So when I started studying Ron Paul's ideas on sound money, I started to see mirrors between his philosophy of sound money based on gold and silver and the philosophies that were expressed of sound money in the Islamic tradition. Most scholars would refer to it as Sunnah money, you know, money that follows the example that was laid out by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And that jumped out at me at first. And then when I saw that, I started looking into more of the economic ideas, and I started seeing more mirrors between what was being advocated by the libertarian and the anarcho-capitalist philosophy and what's advocated in the Islamic legal tradition as far as fair trade. You put your best goods forward, and free trade. You really don't need the state to tell you what you can and can't trade, where you can and can't trade, the worth and the value of what's traded. Adam Smith's concept of the invisible hand is spelled out by Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in the hadith traditions, that God and the two people making the decision are the ones who decide what the price is for goods, not the government, not through some sort of price fixing, which is absolutely forbidden in Islam, but through mutual consent. The Quran specifically states, let there be, do not unjustly consume other people's wealth, except there be trade amongst you by mutual consent. Well, that's an anarcho-capitalist or voluntarist trade policy spelled out, you know, in three sentences.
One of the other things I've always wondered about Islam and its possible ties with anarchism or libertarianism is, I was always taught that Islam meant submission to God, and I kind of feel like that would preclude any submission to state powers or any other type of human being. Do you see that, or am I just off base with that?
No, that submission to God always comes first. Now, you are encouraged to live by and observe the laws of the land in which you live, so long as they don't encourage you to do anything that's specifically forbidden in Islam. But I myself don't agree with the concept of a sovereign state, quote-unquote, because in my religious opinion, sovereignty belongs to God alone. And the right and the ability to make laws rests with God, not with a sovereign entity that is only sovereign because it declares itself so and because of the fact that it has the monopoly of the right to use force against the rest of the people. In a true Islamic state, in a caliphate, which doesn't exist today and hasn't existed for quite a long time, the authority of the state, so to speak, the authority of the caliph is acquired through what's known of as a bayah. It's a mutual oath of understanding through people that is given by personal consent, not through coercion. So you would give your bayah to the caliphate, not through what you call it the social contract, mm-hmm. as is stated today, but you make that decision yourself as an individual, and it cannot be coerced, because if you coerce a pledge, then that's a lie, that's hypocrisy. And if Islam's goal is to inject righteousness into every action, if you coerce these actions, then all you've done is inculcated hypocrisy. You've in no way created righteousness or goodness, because if you put a gun to my head and tell me you have to give this money so that I can give it to these poor people, well, I'm not giving you the money to purify my wealth because it's something that is a good deed, and it's simply because it's something that God wants me to do. I'm doing it because you're physically forcing me through threat of violence against myself, my family, my property, or threat of imprisonment. So it's not a good deed anymore. You take the goodness out of what you've done and basically turned it into a hypocritical thing.
Right, right. So now I also wonder, a lot of people sort of conflate things in their head, and they might see the flaw with modern theocracies like the Islamic Republic of Iran with originating in Islam, but it sounds like it seems more like that flaw originates with the state taking over and co-opting something like Islam to use it as a stick to beat people over the head with. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. My favorite example is people for, unfortunately, they look to Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, as their example of an Islamic government. But when you look at the actions of the Saudi Arabian government and compare them to what is actually advocated and required many times by Sharia, of course, not being any monolith as it's, you know, reinterpreted over and over by different scholars and different schools of thought for 1400 years. But some of the most basic concepts are not enforced or practiced whatsoever in Saudi Arabia. The name itself, Saudi Arabia, is a violation of the Sunnah of Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The land in which they live is, according to Islam, only to be referred to as Al Arabiya, not Al Arabiya Al Saud. In an act of pure arrogance, in my personal opinion, they named that land after themselves and after their tribe, which tribalism, again, is also completely forbidden concept in Islam. Islam came to do away with concepts of tribalism, nationalism, and their money. They have the rial, which is a paper printed currency. They are a part of the, when they created the gold currency in the 1920s.
Bretton Woods.
Thank you. I knew it was a B. The Bretton Woods Declaration. They've signed on to the Bretton Woods Declaration, which technically they put themselves in the place of God and made the forbidden permissible in stating that you can no longer use gold and silver as a sound currency and you have to use the Saudi Royale. If you try to go for Hajj, they declare themselves as a sovereign entity, which, again, as I stated before, only Allah is sovereign. So it's a complete act of arrogance on their part to declare themselves as a sovereign entity. They trade oil with the United States, who's currently at war with Muslim countries and is openly and unapologetically killing Muslim civilians. Oil that is used to make plastic explosives, to fuel fighter jets, to fuel tanks and Humvees that are used in the killing of Muslims, something that they're not allowed to do. But there's a lot of libertarian Muslims you'll find if you just take the time to seek them out. And it's a running joke among the libertarian Muslim community that instead of being Abdullah, servants of God, they're Abdullah, slaves of the dollar. And they put the dollar and the almighty greenback ahead of their faith. And so to look to Saudi as some kind of upright representation of a true Islamic government is an absolute farce. It's lunacy, because there are so many things in their legal tradition and in their government that are absolutely counter to what Islam advocates and teaches.
Right.
And they're not the only one. I mean, there are many other Muslim states that do the same. The only Muslim state right now that has a sound silver-based currency is a little bitty tiny area about the size of a county, like the average U.S. county in Malaysia, called Brunei. They only trade with silver. I have a set of their coins actually in my house that we had wanted to give to Dr. Paul as a gift, but I have yet to be able to set up a time to be able to give him this gift. But they have a sound currency. There are groups in Malaysia that are now being set up to compete against the Malaysian paper dollar. The government of Malaysia is not happy about this. But they are trading in dirhams and dinars, gold and silver coin currency. And there are kind of like the pork fest, the underground economies that you have here in the U.S. through Shire Silver and, you know, Bitcoin and things like that. They're trading with gold and silver currency, even though the government has said you're not allowed to do that.
Right.
So they have their own underground black market economy that they're putting together in Malaysia, in Trinidad, and in other countries across the globe. Where Muslims are tired of the interest-based and debt-based paper money, and they're trying to return forcibly through the Marabitun movement, through the efforts of Sheikh Omar the Dio, Sheikh Imran Hussein, and other scholars that are gaining ground in the Muslim world right now to take sound money back by force without the permission of the government.
Wow. And of course, I think it's important to point out that the state co-opting a theology or a religious ideology and using it for its own violent ends is not restricted to just Islam. I mean, if you look at Christianity, there's, of course, the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, you know, Salem witch trials, all sorts of horrible things in the New World as well.
Buddhists in Myanmar right now, you have Buddhists that are slaughtering Muslims in Burma. They changed the name because, you know, Burma has a bad connotation to it now. They call it Myanmar. Mm-hmm. But I guess after slaughtering 30,000 members of a minority group through the use of your religious leadership, I guess they're going to have to change the name from Myanmar to something else as well. You also have Hindus doing the same thing to Christians, to Muslims in India with the support of the government. The government just kind of turns a blind eye to the fact that these religious groups are committing genocide. You have Christians in Africa slaughtering indigenous tribal people in Africa. Kony 2012, you know, that whole big thing that went around a few months back. Joseph Kony is a self-professed Christian. He professes that his movement is a Christian movement. And they have, by all means and standards, their own government within his movement that he is the leader of. So you have this in all religious traditions, both in antiquity and today.
Right. And it's important to separate that that violence and that state action inherent to them, which is their real goal, is conquest or some type of violence. They just dress themselves up in a cloak of religiosity often.
Well, sociopaths are sociopaths. However they try to justify their actions to themselves and to others does not change the fact that they're sociopaths.
I also wanted to ask you, with pretty much all the mainstream political spectrum in the U.S. Being hostile to Islam, in my opinion, either domestically or in the foreign policy realm, you'd said earlier there are a lot of Muslims in the libertarian movement. Do you see a lot of interest? Like what kind of percentage breakdown? I don't know if there's been any studies, but do you feel like a lot of the American Muslim community is moving towards a different option than just being a Democrat or Republican?
Absolutely. I see Muslims are disaffected by the – up until 2004, Muslims voted in an overwhelming majority for the Republican Party because of the social values platform that the Republican Party was advocating. Then with the advent of the war of terror, whatever you want to call it, Muslims started to move away from that. Then you see the anti-Islam Luniverse, the Pam Geller, Robert Spencer, Brigitte Gabriel types being embraced by many people in the Republican Party. So you saw a huge exodus of Muslims away from the GOP toward the Democrats with the Obama election. Then Obama got in office and immediately took over and continued the policies, both domestic and foreign, of George W. Bush. He may have removed certain references to Islam from Department of Homeland Security books, but he hasn't changed the policies that those books were used to enforce. I would actually argue that Obama is far more aggressive against the Muslim community, because at least under George Bush, whenever there were Muslims being arrested for terrorism, it was terrorism that Muslims themselves were committing, and they were coming up with these ideas and putting these attacks together themselves. They weren't being specifically harvested and created by the administration, I think personally, just as a way to look tough on terrorism because of the fact that he gets so much flack from the GOP. You know, we didn't have the FBI going out and creating terrorist attacks, handing over fake weapons to these people, blocking them from leaving. You know, the guy in Oregon, he was like, you know what, I've decided I don't want to do this, and tried to move to Alaska, and they blocked him from being able to move. He wanted to move and go create a life for himself somewhere else and get out of it. And our government did everything they could to prevent him from leaving extremism so that they would have a patsy. So I would personally argue that the Obama administration is far more aggressive toward the Muslim population than the Bush administration was. So you see Muslims leaving the parties in droves. And they're finding homes in the Libertarian Party and in the Green Party, because you have the social values Muslims who advocate a socialist society based on their own understanding of Islam, which I, in my own personal opinion, is flawed, because they use the coercion of the state to enforce these social values. And then you have the Muslims that are leaving because of the concepts of freedom that they're learning in their own traditions through the efforts of myself and groups like the Minaret of Freedom and other organizations. And they're moving into anarcho-capitalist, agorist, voluntarist, and libertarian movements because they're finding a voice there. They're finding that they're being embraced there, that people are listening to them and are willing to hear what they have to say, are willing to act like they're members of the party, and aren't willing to throw them under the bus whenever it's politically expedient for them, whenever they see it as something that's profitable to use anti-Muslim stereotypes or to make statements in favor of Muslims and then recant them. You're not seeing that in these smaller parties the same way that you see in the two major parties. So the disaffected Muslim population is either becoming completely apathetic toward politics and just not being involved in it whatsoever, refusing to vote, refusing to be a part of the system, or they're trying to change the system through these other groups, these third party movements that have come about, you know, over the course of the last 25 years.
Right. And this anti-Islam luniverse, as you put it, I think it does a lot of harm to the general American populace in general, not just the Muslim community, but this is sort of the scapegoat that they use to take away a lot of civil liberties and to steal your money to go fight more wars and end up getting American soldiers killed as well. So I wonder if a lot of the work you do is not just to sort of show Muslims this way and sort of do teaching on that along those lines, but are you also sort of trying to counteract those sort of hardcore anti-Islam characters in American mainstream media who sort of try to instill a fear of, say, Sharia law taking over the American legal system?
Whenever we get the opportunity, we don't simply counteract, we confront directly. I'm the kind of guy that I'm not scared of you or your dad or your gun or your government or anything else. If I see something that's wrong, I'm going to either change it with my hands or change it with my mouth and speak out against it directly. And I'm going to confront those people in a direct manner. I'm not going to, write an article or whine or run to the Council of American Islamic Relations and beg them for protection. I'm going to go confront these people directly. When the head of the Center for the Study of Political Islam, his name is Bill Warner or Bill French, whichever moniker he chooses to go by at the time. He has a degree in physics, which means that he's really smart. But that doesn't mean that he has the qualifications to study or understand Islamic law or to study or understand theology in general. If you want to have a heart surgery done, you don't go to an ASD, a certified mechanic. You go to a heart surgeon because he's the one who's trained and studied in the area of expertise that you need that help in. And that's what we have now, is we have people who are trained in another area, and therefore they have clout that they're smart, but they're not trained at all in the area in which they're discussing, though they are hailed as experts by the media in these areas. When he came to the town that I live in now in Maryville, Tennessee, I was putting together an Islam Awareness Week at the local library and, you know, just putting some Islamic artwork and different things that I had in some cases for display. And the newspaper guy came out to take some pictures and told me, he's like, so are you going to this tea party thing tonight? This guy is coming to discuss the dangers of Sharia in America. So we went to this event and confronted him directly while he was on stage. He asked for questions and it was not a good day for him. He hinged his entire argument on a doctrinal theory that arose 300 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that is highly contested, has multiple interpretations, called The Theory of Abrogation. And I asked him one very simple question. You showed us five verses that you say are abrogated by another verse. Which scholar of abrogation did you get this information from? Which scholar of abrogation do you cite? And rather than answering the question directly and just giving me the scholar's name, he decided to reword my question back to me and then go on to the next questioner, which to the people who weren't there simply as blind followers of him who wanted to have their viewpoint and their personal prejudices validated, that was a very telling. Now, I wrote a thesis on the theory of abrogation. It's been printed on a few websites. And so for him to hinge his entire argument on that theory was not a good thing to do for me with me in the audience, because he has someone who's very well versed in the theory of abrogation and the scholars of abrogation, who understands that some scholars say there's 200 verses that are abrogated. Some say 34, some say 19, some say 6, some say, and they all disagree on which verses are abrogated and which verses abrogate other verses. So if you're going to give a scholarly opinion, then you need to have the ability to cite the scholar's opinion that you're using to back up your claim.
Right.
I've called into radio shows to confront anti-Muslim loons on more than one occasion. I have people now that send me messages on Facebook and write emails to me. Hey, this person's going to be on this radio station. This person's going to be on this show at this time. And we call in. There was a debate between the leader of the United West, Tom Trento, in Florida, with a gentleman named Chris Ingram. And the director of the 10th Amendment Center in Florida wrote me an email. He's a good personal friend of mine, and was like, look, this guy needs somebody to help him out, and none of the Muslim organizations seem to be interested in doing so. Would you and your organization be willing to sit with this guy and prepare him for this debate? And we were happy to do so. The fact that he's a Republican didn't change the fact that he was standing up for our community and that we needed to stand behind him as a community and support that. So we provided him with the concepts, the basic principles that are laid out in Maqasid and in the Qawaid al-Fiqh, the legal maxims of Islamic law. This is like the 10 amendments to the Constitution. These are legal maxims that are set out to be very short quips that explain very broad ideas in the Islamic legal tradition for the layman to be able to understand, like the right to bear arms, the Second Amendment. That's not what the Second Amendment says. It's a full paragraph. But the right to bear arms would be the maxim that expresses what's in that amendment.
Right.
So in the Islamic legal tradition, a glaring one, it's one of the first five generally agreed upon normative maxims, is that you can't attribute guilt to someone until it's been proven. It's anything that's certainty can't be overruled by doubt. Now, what we see that as in the American legal tradition is the presumption of innocence. Mm-hmm. Now, that there's a big paragraph that explains what that whole thing means, but in a short quip, it's that certainty can't be overruled by doubt. The norm of Sharia is that of non-liability, is another one that expresses that same idea. No man can be held legally liable for any action, be it religious, civil, or criminal, until it's proven before a qualified judge with clear evidence, not circumstantial evidence, that this person is guilty of such offense, be it civil, criminal, or religious. Again, like I said, that's the presumption of innocence, just laid out in a different way. And we gave him the ability to go in and confront this guy directly, because unfortunately, I've never got the opportunities to do so.
Sounds like some real excellent work.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Yeah.
Want to contribute to liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents. All right, well, one of the other things I wanted to ask you, and we've sort of talked about this previously about Sharia, but I want you to give us a sort of simple breakdown counter-argument to, you know, the dad spams and things people get in their emails and the Luniverse, their argument that Sharia law is taking over America. Give us the quick, dirty, simple, you guys are full of crap.
First of all, there are many, many concepts and precepts that exist in the Islamic law that are in the United States Constitution. Many of them originated in the Islamic legal tradition. They were borrowed historically through, you know, borrowing happened in antiquity between legal traditions, and they were adapted into the common law. And then after being adapted into the common law, they were, you know, changed and reformed into the constitutional law by our founding fathers. One of the most influential philosophers on our founding fathers was John Locke, who openly admitted that most of his concepts were influenced by the writings of an Islamic legal philosopher named Ibn Tufayl. So the fact that the idea that Sharia is quote unquote taking over America doesn't make sense, because a lot of our common precepts already exist in the constitutional tradition. So I don't see how one legal system can take over another legal system with this, when they share so many commonalities. Secondly, I don't understand how 1.6% of the American population is somehow going to overthrow and enforce its will on the other 99.4% of the population. You know, I mean, that's just absolute lunacy.
Right.
But, you know, never allow facts to get in the way of good rhetoric and propaganda. Something that's really interesting that I think was the one thing that jumped out at me, that grabbed me the most and pulled me closer to libertarianism, they're the five basic principles of the Islamic legal tradition. Imam al-Qarafi, Maliki Sheikh, who I have the utmost of respect for, added a sixth, but the five, they're called the Maqasid al-Sharia. They are as follows. Number one is the protection of life. The Maqasid preserves the sanctity of life. No one can harm your ability to live or your person without due cause or in self-defense. No one can take your life unless it's in a life or death self-defense situation, unless the state apparatus has been provided with sufficient evidence proving your guilt of a capital offense punishable by the death penalty. The Quran backs this up in chapter 6, verse number 151, when it says, "Do not slay any soul, as God has made it sacred, except by the way of justice." The second is the protection of liberty, religious liberty most specifically. Anything that comes between you and the divine has to be eliminated. The religious observances of non-Muslims living under an Islamic a caliphate must be protected by the Muslim rulers. And there are actually laws that are made in different Muslim kingdoms. In Morocco, they made special laws to protect the Jews because they were being oppressed. When you read the rules of warfare, even in the rules of warfare, it says that, you know, you're not to tear down churches. Monastic leaders, priests and such are to be left to their, you know, to their ways and to their prayer and their devotions. The stories of Salah ad-Din going in and standing the crosses and the churches back up after the taking of Jerusalem. So the freedom of the non-Muslim religious minorities is protected. Imam al-Qarafi actually states in his Al-Faruq that the non-Muslim minority, should they be invaded by either Muslims or by non-Muslim outside invaders, that it is absolutely incumbent upon the Muslim majority to take up arms and fight to the death if necessary and give their lives to protect them. When he added the sixth maxim to the Maqasid, he was discussing that the people of protected status, the non-Muslims living in a Muslim state, that it is a sin and a violation of a covenant given by both God and His Messenger, sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wa sallam, to molest them in any way, to assault their honor, to assault their property, to harm their person, or to assist in doing so. The protection of intellect, the right to think, the ability to think and reason for oneself is actually paramount under the Islamic legal tradition. The preservation of intellect is one of the reasons behind the prohibition of intoxicants. In the Quran, in chapter 8, verse number 22, God says, "Indeed, the vilest of living creatures in God's sight are the deaf and dumb, those who refuse to use their intellect." The fourth is the protection of lineage. Everyone has the right to be born in wedlock, thus preserving an individual's claim to lineage and preserving their psychological connection to their ancestors. It's one of the reasons why slavery is, though permissible, very, very discouraged. And one of the reasons why adultery and fornication are forbidden is because lineage cannot be attributed to a child who is the product of adultery or fornication. And the last of these rights, which is also listed by John Locke and then broadened by Jefferson, is the protection of private property. No one can damage or take your duly acquired property. The Quran says, "Do not consume one another's property unjustly, except there be trade amongst you by mutual consent." I mentioned that earlier. That's Surah Al-Nisa, chapter 4, verse number 29. So you can be a Muslim and be a communist, because communists don't advocate the rights of private property.
Right.
So if you take those five and you distill them down, you come out with 1, 2, and 5, the right to life, the right to religious liberty, and the right to property, which in the original penning of the Declaration is exactly how Jefferson discussed and expressed what our society here would be based on: the right to life, liberty, and estate, property.
Right. And I think most people can get on board with those. Obviously, the things that sort of stick in my head are the prohibition of things like alcohol and spirits, and I imagine that might apply to other mind-altering substances as well.
But that only applies to those Muslims who live within right. the Muslim state. There's a famous discussion between the Caliph Umar ibn Abdul Aziz in the 8th century and the chief religious scholar of his time, Al-Hasan al-Basri. And he wrote a letter, Aziz wrote a letter to Al-Hasan al-Basri and was lamenting. He was upset about the fact that the Rashidun, which were the first four successors to Muhammad, and the Prophet sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wa sallam himself, had allowed the Christians and the Jews and the non-Muslims living under the Muslim protection to continue to ferment and consume wine, to continue to raise and consume pork, and to continue to marry close relatives. And Al-Hasan al-Basri replied back, you know, they pay their taxes as a part of the state, and this is the law, and you will not change it and make something new to please yourself. So, and that is used as an expression and a form of evidence for the third of the Qawaid al-Fiqh, the normative maxims of Islamic law, is that culture dictates intention. So whatever is considered appropriate according to your own culture is what is considered permissible to your culture under Islamic law. So if America was a Sharia-compliant state and the American culture deemed that the consumption of alcohol and marijuana were permissible, then to those communities that was their culture, it would be permissible. If the gay marriage or abortion were considered permissible, which abortion is a highly debated topic among the four schools of Islamic thought, some allowing it, some completely forbidding it. It would be allowed for you if that was your specific culture. The Islamic legal tradition would only be applied to people up to the point where their personal traditions or cultures stop.
How personal can your cultures and traditions get in your reading of it? Could I, for instance, just in a group of one, myself, decide to opt out and say, hey, I believe such and such, you know, I should be able to go out and party on a Friday night and, I don't know, huff paint or inhale Freon or some other ridiculous thing, even though the majority of people don't think that that is appropriate? Would that still be...
Cut off would be when you decide to harm someone else or someone else's property.
Okay.
That's the main cutoff. Now, that's... You know, I'm not a I'm no mujtahid at this point. Unfortunately, I hope in 20 years or so to be qualified to make ijtihad on a topic like that. From my own understanding, and Allah knows best, if you're not Muslim, your specific culture would apply to you up to the point where you decided to destroy or take someone else's life or property. As soon as you cross the boundaries of harming another individual or unjustly usurping the rights of another individual's property, that's usually where the Sharia will kick in and be like, okay, you have now delved into the areas where the Islamic legal tradition holds sway. But then again, you have competing court systems in the Islamic legal tradition. So you have Christians going to Christian courts that are arbitrated by Christian scholars that enforce Christian law on the Christian community. You have Jewish courts that are arbitrated by Jewish law within the Jewish community. And most times, most offenses are taken care of within the community. And this is actually encouraged both by Quran and by the verbal traditions of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where, you know, he was approached by two Jewish men who asked him to judge between them. And he said, you know, do you not have the Torah that was given to you to judge among yourselves? But then the Quran goes further to state that if they come to you, you know, encourage them to go and judge between themselves. But if you do judge between them with justice. Because justice is next to piety, and God is well acquainted with all that you do. And for all of those out there who love to throw the theory of abrogation around, that's in the very last chapter of the Quran to be revealed. So it can't possibly have been abrogated by any verse that you want to pull out and try to throw around. Because the theory of abrogation states that older revelations abrogate newer revelations. Well, this is the last of the revelations. This is the very last of the chapters to be revealed. So it can't possibly be abrogated by anything else because everything else came before it.
Okay. So it sounds like, according to your reading, people have the right inherently to choose sort of their own judge, choose who will be the legal system. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, yeah. You have, like I, as I said, you have competing legal systems, competing economic systems, competing monies. Competing educational systems. That's one of the things that when I discovered existed in Islam pushed me further into the ANCAP philosophy, even away from libertarianism a little bit, and further to the right, to the black and yellow, was when I started reading about the way the educational system worked in Egypt, the fact that competing currencies and competing legal traditions are not only accepted but are encouraged and advocated in Islam. There's a statement made by Umar ibn al-Khattab in one of the biographies about him where he's sitting with his older brother before he accepted Islam and discussing camels. And the brother, you know, asked him, how are you so good with the camels? And he says, well, because you have to treat each one of them like an individual. They have their own wants, their own likes, their own dislikes, their own temperaments. And that when you know how to address them as individuals and take care of them as individuals, it gives you a better ability to take care of them as a herd. And that this is expressed the most in people. That when you have the ability to understand people as individuals, it gives you a greater ability to understand how to take care of them and how to understand them as a group. That was Omar ibn al-Khattab, for those who are unaware, was a companion, one of Muhammad's most trusted and loved companions, as well as the second successor to the caliphate after the death of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wa sallam.
Okay. I want to take a little different direction here. There's a fantastic documentary called Heavy Metal in Baghdad. It's about an Iraqi heavy metal group. I think they're called Arisakud Kauda, some Latin name that means spider or something like that. It's a great documentary about them, you know, trying to play their music during the American occupation of Iraq. And one of the band members basically points to his belief that the Sunni versus Shia conflict is overblown by the media. He says something to the effect of, well, I'm Sunni and my wife is Shia, so I think it's just BS. I don't think there's a big conflict. Do you see there being a big conflict? How do you feel about this sort of meme in Western media that that's what causes a lot of strife and war in the Islamic world?
Well, first of all, the war between Iraq and Iran was a secular government versus a Shia government. So there was no Sunni versus Shia there. The Saudi government and the extremism that they openly fund with U.S. tax dollars, that we send them billions and billions worth in subsidies every year, fund and push this ideology all across the globe. I've had friends of mine who I had the utmost of respect for who tried to inject their views on this into our personal relationship with one another, and I've had to defriend them. You know, Sunni Muslims who say that Shias aren't Muslim, when that's only been an argument here recently with the arising of the Najdi. Most people call them Wahhabis, but I prefer not to use that term, as al-Wahhab is one of the names and attributes of God, and I try not to use God's names or attributes in a disparaging manner. So I call them Najdis, because their scholar, their patron saint, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab al-Najd, came from the land of Najd, which is a specific area of Saudi Arabia, that it was foretold that the greatest evil that ever will exist would arise from there and basically destroy our religion and the entire world along with it. They're pushing this because they want a sectarian civil war. The sectarian civil wars are mostly over. Now it's more about Sunni leaders who are kept in power through Saudi Arabia and through American foreign intervention that have Shia majorities, like Bahrain. Bahrain is a majority Shia country, but they have a Sunni king, and they have no voice in their government, and they haven't, you know, they're literally an oppressed people. The Saudis push the sectarian idea because they want hegemony in the Middle East. They want to be the big dogs on the block. Iran is a competitor of theirs, so of course they hate the Shia, because the Shia are their main competitors in the oil markets right now and politically. So I think that the media does overblow it a lot, but I do think that there are other forces involved in this that are involved with states. You know, it always boils down to the state.
Yeah.
That are encouraging and inciting this past the point of what it should be. I work with an organization. We do not in any way, shape, or form advocate sectarianism with Muslims for Liberty. When we got started, it was a Shia organization that gave us our first batch of media materials. When we started a campaign to create Islamic media libraries at local public libraries here, it was the same people from that same Shia organization that sent me books and videos and DVDs by the case. So, you know, I've been working with Shia and with Sufis since I started doing this kind of work. But I also work with Sunnis. I myself, I see myself as a Muslim, most people would call me, since I follow the Maliki school of jurisprudence, a Sunni Muslim. But I really try to avoid those kinds of labels in my religious community, because all it does is it creates the division that's necessary, just like Democrat and Republican. It creates the division that is necessary for those people who want money and power and are willing to use force and oppression to get it, to have the ability to divide the people so that they can. Because as long as we're fighting with each other, we won't have the ability to fight back against those who really oppress us.
I want to get your take on what's going on in Syria. Do you have any insights? Do you follow foreign policy? I would imagine you do.
Yes.
Go ahead and give us your take on what's going on.
Well, I have friends on the ground that live in Syria that feed me information on a regular basis. First things first, Bashar Assad is a monster. He is a evil person personally. His Alawite government is a Shia minority that is enforcing its will on a Sunni majority. Most Shia reject the Alawite doctrine because they ascribe divinity and make Ali ibn Abu Talib, radiallahu ta'ala anhu, the cousin and son-in-law and the fourth caliph of Islam, the cousin and son-in-law of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, with divinity. They make him into a god, and that is rejected by the majority of Shia Muslims and all Sunni Muslims. But the revolution is going in the wrong direction. We have CIA, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia sending their people in, the CIA sending their people in, the Mossad in there, and basically, you have the true mujahideen, the true people who are fighting and struggling for their freedom from an oppressive government, who are the Syrian people. Then you have the serially oppressed, those people who have lived under oppression for so long that they would fight to continue their own oppression. And then you have the fake mujahideen. These, you know, Gulf State Arabs who go in and they slaughter people indiscriminately. They kill Sunni Muslims who disagree with them. They desecrate Sufi shrines and kill Sufi Muslims that disagree with them. They kill Shia. They kill Christians. They kill anybody and everybody who disagrees with their specific methodology and their specific interpretation of Islam that is packaged and exported directly from Saudi Arabia. And when you have the CIA and the Mossad get involved, they always end up just like in Libya, where we had a known Al-Qaeda operative who I thought Al-Qaeda was supposed to be the bad guys, who's in charge of the revolutionary forces in Libya, and we're pumping money and pumping weapons and pumping political clout into this person who 5 years ago we were throwing him in a cage. We're throwing the bad guys in cages, quote-unquote bad guys. And then we let them out and then send them overseas to start revolutions in countries that we want to take over. So Assad is a madman and a monster who kills people indiscriminately. But so are these fake revolutionaries that are over there. I got a video from a girl the other day where the Najdis from Saudi Arabia kidnapped a group of people and said that they were a part of the Syrian army and executed them on video. And then 3 days later, uploaded a video with the same exact dead bodies and said that they were members of the civilian population and they had been killed by Assad.
Wow. What do you think is the motivation for this kind of hysteria? I've heard it said that the CIA, the Americans, the Israelis are using this conflict in Syria as a way to hopefully intervene and deprive Iran of having an ally, basically to pressure Iran because of the whole conflict there. Do you buy that line?
You know, it could be possible. I have my own viewpoints from my study of Islamic eschatology as to what's really going on. It's more of a religious viewpoint than a political viewpoint. Not sure, you know, that being as most of your listeners are more of the political persuasion, if they would be interested in that. If they are interested in that, then they can get they can get information on it from someone who's far, far more qualified from me. If they go on YouTube and look up Imran Hussein and listen to some of his lectures where he discusses the Arab Spring and what's going on with the Arab Spring. He does one, it's called Arab Spring to Arab Slaughter, where it discusses the American and Israeli and Saudi Arabian influences on the Arab Spring in Egypt and in Tunisia and in Libya and in Syria, and discusses it from a more religious viewpoint, which is a more religious viewpoint than a political viewpoint, that this is all something that is being done purposely to work itself out to a greater end that will eventually end up with a single government and a single monetary policy globally.
Ah. Well, let's talk about your political viewpoint, because we've mostly been talking about religion and legal theories from your point of view. Do you consider yourself an anarchist right now? Do you believe there's no role for the state in a civilized society?
I see myself as somewhat of a pseudo-anarcho-capitalist.
Why pseudo?
Well, because I do advocate for the reinstatement of the caliphate, but a state that it's not a state by modern definitions. The state by the modern definition is that entity which has the monopoly of the right to use force and coercive violence against the populace. The caliphate isn't a state by that definition. The state is a sovereign entity quote-unquote, entity that derives its authority from its right to use force and violence against the people. Well, as I stated before, the caliphate doesn't gain its authority from the right to use violence against the people, but through a mutual pledge that's given without coercion. So my definition of an Islamic state in no way resembles a state by a modern definition. So if you say that, do I advocate for a state by a modern definition? If I say no, that makes me an anarchist, then yes, I am an anarchist. But I say pseudo-anarchist because I do advocate a form of a state, just not a state by the way that it's defined in modern terminology. State that derives its power from mutual consent, not through coercive violence, or it's basically the social contract and the fact that it's acknowledged by the United Nations and its very existence.
Right. So, yeah, I guess that would not fall into my definition of the state. If you had the option to opt out, if you could say, well, I don't really – that's not my philosophy. That's not my theology. I choose not to participate in your courts or your legal system or abide by your prescriptions. Would that be an option in your ideal future caliphate?
Yes. Okay. Yes. That would be an option, which is why it's not a state by modern definitions.
Right.
That's also why, like I said, I advocate a state, but a state is a state through mutual consent, like a voluntarist state, not a coercive state.
So why even call it a state then?
Why do I call it a state?
Yeah.
Well, because it has an apparatus and a leader.
Okay.
So it does have an apparatus and it does have court systems. And a state has all of those things, but it doesn't derive its authority in the same way that a modern state does. So it is it's a state, but not a state by modern definitions.
Okay, fair enough. I want to get into some big picture stuff, and this will probably wrap it up after we're done here. Are you familiar with Ibn Khaldun?
Ibn Khaldun, yes.
Okay. I'm a Muslim scholar by no means. I'm not Muslim. And I did take a few classes in college, though, and one of them was a whole course on Ibn Khaldun. One of the things that stuck out for me, and I guess this is one of his more cited type theories, is sort of to me the idea of inevitability of decay of what he calls great civilizations. Basically that in time, new generations of, say, an empire will become more sedentary, less hardworking, less vigilant. And to him, it's almost a cycle. They'll eventually be conquered by barbarians and they'll start the cycle over again. And I feel like I see modern parallels, you know, with the American empire. A lot of libertarians are fond of pointing out that the American empire is no exception and will fall or can fall to the same fate of the Roman Empire. how do you feel about that line of thought? And also, do you think there is a way to break the cycle, or do you think history and mankind is doomed to sort of fall along and repeat itself and always sort of have these violent states and empires?
Well, the problem is the bestial nature of man. It is the base nature of man to be greedy and to seek power, to seek glory, to seek riches. And eventually, that trumps principle in every society. It happened with the Romans. It happened with the Byzantines. It happened with the Greeks. It happened with the Egyptians. And it happened with the Brits. And it's happening with the United States. Nationalism and unity trumps principle with the Civil War. And then principle now trumps unity with the empire. Greed trumped principle now with our empire. And nationalism trumps principle with our empire. You know, we have the ability as people to turn a blind eye to the suffering of others. As long as it's not happening to our family and it's happening somewhere else, we have the ability to turn a blind eye to it. It's removed from us personally, so it really doesn't exist to us. And as long as humankind has that bestial nature in itself, there's really nothing that we'll be able to do to stop that cycle. It will continue. From my religious opinion, it will end one day. But we are, and from my religious opinion, the American empire will fall. That's not just my religious opinion as a Muslim. That's a Christian's religious opinion. That's a Jew's religious opinion. Every Abrahamic religion is of the opinion that one day the world will be ruled by a single global government with a single global currency, which means that America has to fall, because that global government will be ruled from a seat in Jerusalem. Well, Jerusalem is not Washington, D.C. So that means that there has to come an empire that will defeat and utterly destroy and subjugate the American empire. From an eschatological, you know, an end time study point of view, it has to happen. And as from a more philosophical point of view, it has to happen because it is the nature of man to consume and to consume and consume and consume until they literally consume themselves into oblivion, because they always want more. And people in power are willing to sacrifice those who are not in power in order to get to that point. So, look at America now. We watch the political parties change their rules. We watch them trounce on the Constitution. We watch them take our rights and our liberties. Some of us, not myself included, allow them to molest our children and our wives and ourselves in order to travel, in order to go to places. We've allowed the government to take our dignity away, because people are animals. We're dumb, panicked cows. We're easily herded into groups. Even you and I, as individualists, we are part of groups. And the problem is it's not in man's nature really to stand up to oppression until it gets to the point that the gun is put against his head. And as long as we have the air conditioning, Snooki, Jersey Shore, Food Network, cable TV, as long as we have these amenities and these comforts, the gun is not to our heads yet, until it's our brother, our sister, ourself that is in the shackles of government. We won't stand up. And even then, the few people that do stand up, we just label them terrorists and go on about our daily business. So that it won't change as long as that's going on.
So in your opinion, you don't really see this cycle being broken. It basically will get worse and go along these sort of lines until, I guess, divine intervention?
Basically, yeah, until the end of time.
Well, usually we don't end it on such a negative note, but it's not a negative note for you, because you believe there will be an end time and a divine intervention, right?
Yeah, I believe that there will be a point where the cycle is broken, where, you know, good eventually does win, that there will be, you know, that this global government will exist, that it will take over. It will be blood and sweat and destruction and horror for every religious tradition, Muslim, non-Muslim alike. We will all suffer under the yoke of this oppressive system that, I mean, most people that aren't blind can see it's kind of being put together right now with the organized global economic collapse that's happened, the destabilization of global government, of governments across the globe, that there's got to be a reason why all of this stuff has been set up to happen on purpose. People, the bankers didn't set all this up just so they could sit back and watch it all burn and laugh. They did it for a purpose. There's a reason to their madness. They have an end solution. They're just waiting for the proper time to offer it to the people, who at that point will be so oppressed and poor and starving and in such dire straits that they'll be happy to accept just about anything, just so long as they feel that it will improve their personal situation. But that there will be a time that good does win out in the end, and that the evil is destroyed, and that cycle is broken. And there will be a time where, you know, people will be able to live on earth in harmony with each other, and go back to trading freely, to using money and having the rights of free association and the right of you know, competing ideas and competing views again. It'll come again. I believe, again, from my own theological point of view, that it will be a hard, bloody battle before we get there.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't share your theology necessarily, but I think you may be right that things could get a lot worse before they get a lot better. Certainly seems that way if you watch the news or read. And I do think that things will turn out in the end. I don't know if that will be at the hand of a benevolent God or not, because I haven't delved that deep into it. But I kind of share the timeline thoughts on that. Anything else you'd like to say to wrap this up, Will, or anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
Yeah, I'd love for your listeners to check out our website. We have lots of articles that we write on different topics. Why should Muslim fundamentalists embrace voluntarist anarchy? Is libertarian compatible with Islam? You can go to Muslims for Liberty. That's Muslims, the number 4, liberty.org. You can go on YouTube. We have videos where we discuss how government gets in the way of poor people being able to make a life better for themselves. We also have some of the articles that we have written are in video format, so that you don't have to take the time to read it. You could just click play and listen to it while you're doing your thing online. If you're the head of a Young Americans for Liberty chapter or a Muslim Students Association, we've done lectures at universities across the U.S. as a guest of both of these organizations. We would love the opportunity to come out and discuss the concepts of libertarianism as they're expressed in the Islamic legal tradition in a far more structured format than a radio interview. And you know, everybody that's out there fighting and doing everything that they can for their own personal freedom and for the freedom of each other, do not be discouraged. Don't stop. Keep fighting forward. Thank you for having us on, and you know, for taking the time to allow us to talk to your listeners about the work that we do and about the ideas that we express, both in the Muslim community and to the non-Muslim community. And, you know, don't always believe everything you hear on TV or read on the internet.
Or anything.
For real.
You'll see on TV.
Don't believe me. That's, you know, that's one of my favorite things to say is, please, yeah. I don't want you to believe a single word that I've said today. I want you to go and I want you to look it up yourself. Go to Muslims for Liberty. Read the articles. Everything that I've said is offered with source information so that you can back check my facts, back check my sources, and see, do these ideas really exist in the legal tradition? Is everything that I'm saying true? Is this quote-unquote taqiyya, as the anti-Muslim loons like to call it, Or am I simply trying to express something that exists in the Islamic legal tradition that has been forgotten? I'm not an apologist who likes to see something from Islam in everything that I look at. I work to reintroduce the Muslim community and the regular non-Muslim community to the concepts of freedom that are ingrained in all of our traditions, so that we can better express them and so that we can give the rights to one another that are owed to one another.
Excellent. Well, it was wonderful having you on, Will, and I hope you continue to work at what you're doing. I think it has a great benefit to society in general.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll go ahead and leave you. Good night, folks.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. We have Freedom Fiends, Anarchy Gumbo, and two designs for Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $6 for four buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.